My guest today, Ray McGovern, is a retired CIA officer who holds an MA in Russian Studies from Fordham University, a certificate in Theological Studies from Georgetown University, and he was a graduate of Harvard Business School's Advanced Management Program. He worked as a CIA analyst from 1963 to 1990, and in the 1980s he chaired National Intelligence Estimate and prepare the President's Daily Intelligence Brief. He received the Intelligence Commendation Medal at his retirement. His current work includes commenting on intelligence issues. 2003, he co-founded Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. While I've interviewed Ray several times and have communicated with him for more than a decade, we finally had a chance to meet each other last week's summit at the U.S.-Israel relationship in Washington. So welcome, Ray McGovern, to Takes on the World.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, it was great to see you and finally meet you. You know, listening to reading the daily reports on the situation in Ukraine and Crimea, I try to think how Lewis Carroll or Jonathan Swift would have described the situation and the seemingly shameful and hypocritical utterances coming out of the mouths of our public officials from the president on down. I'm not a fan of Vladimir Putin, but am I missing something?
No, John Kerry and Barack Obama get up decrying any country that might violate the territorial integrity of another country as being, you know, 19th century or 20th century sort of behavior. You know, I just have to say, Jeff, that it strikes me as, giving hypocrisy a bad name here. I mean, when you look at Iraq, for which John Kerry voted, the war in Iraq. When you look at Libya, when you look at the almost war against Syria, and so on and so forth, the U.S. is not in any position, unfortunately, at this point, to stand up and decry the violation of territorial integrity of one country by another. Now, that's not to say that that Putin did the right thing in going into the Crimea, if that's exactly what he did. It remains a little bit unclear to me how many of those self-defense forces were already there. But suffice it to say that he is there, and that for the neocons, the neoconservatives that run our policy toward that part of the world, for them to think that they could mount a putsch to get out a duly elected government, however corrupt it was, in Kiev and in Ukraine, and the Russians wouldn't notice that, the Russians wouldn't do anything about it. For them to have thought that, if indeed that's what they thought, strikes me as, you know, middle schoolish, thinking that the Russians wouldn't like care. Of course they care. They've always cared about that part of their southern underbelly. So it may be that the neocons have something bigger in mind, and their vilification of Putin over the last couple of weeks certainly shows that they're out to damage or to start up as cold a war as they can resume. Maybe that's the name of the game, you know, the colder the war, the more intense the cold war, the more weapons you can sell to people who now belong to NATO and used to belong to the Warsaw Pact before it was dissolved. It's somebody's make a lot of money out of this stuff. Somebody's thinking that they are profiting. And the sooner the president gets on to them, the better.
Well, it's interesting, amazing, watching pictures that I saw on YouTube of Victoria Nuland, the new neocon wife of one of the most notorious neocons of them all, Robert Kagan, marching with U.S. ambassador among protesters in Kiev. And I could imagine what the reaction would have been in the United States during the Vietnam War had a Russian diplomat or the Russian ambassador joined anti-war protest in the United States. It's amazing that Yanukovych didn't actually ask Nuland and the ambassador to get on the next plane out of the country. Whatever one thinks of Yanukovych and his corruption, the audacity of the Americans just openly promoting regime change, which is what they were doing, is just mind-blowing, and seems to, actually, that aspect seems to have been missing now from the media. We had the story when the Russians presumably tape-recorded Nuland talking about her boy Yahtzee and how he should run the Ukraine, and used the F word at the end of her conversation because the European Union wasn't on board with this full sanctions program that Nuland was behind. But they ignored what I think is the most important part of the conversation, was that the U.S. actually activity to overthrow a duly elected government. No?
Yeah, and Jeff, it's very rare. It's extremely rare that you get either documentary or unassailable intercepted communications documentary evidence that this kind of thing is afoot. Now, when that telephone conversation between Victoria Nuland, Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, and this fellow Pyatt, Jeffrey Pyatt, who was the U.S. ambassador in Kiev, Ukraine, when that was revealed, you know, went right up on YouTube, and this is about 3 weeks ago, and it was, I guess, recorded 4 or 5 weeks ago. Well, since they picked, you know, who should be the next prime minister, Yats, they apparently didn't take the trouble to learn how to pronounce Yatsenyuk, so it was just Yats, and Yats is our guy, and the other guy should wait in the wings, but Yats is our guy because, you know, he used to be head of the central bank. He knows exactly what's necessary in terms of the austerity measures that the IMF will require and the Wall Street bankers and so forth. So he's our guy, and, you know, we'll see to it that everybody knows that. Now, one would have thought that once that message was exposed, well, it would be far too embarrassing for Yats to become the prime minister. But guess what? They put in my subtitle in the piece I wrote, yikes, it's Yats. Yats is now not only the interim prime minister, but he's in Washington now, and he's going to meet with the president this afternoon, and he's going to give a press conference at the National Press Club late afternoon, early evening. So I don't know what kind of world the neocons and the people close to the president are living in, but this is a no-win situation for them. It's extraordinarily embarrassing. And even if our West European allies, writ large, are too embarrassed or too intimidated to criticize the U.S., they're certainly laughing up their sleeves because we get caught big time. And if we're going to be a bunch of thugs duking it out, I'm from the Bronx, so you have to pardon the analogy. If we're going to be a bunch of thugs going into a different neighborhood schoolyard, you know, well, we got to be careful because that different neighborhood will have different ideas about our thugs. And if it's their neighborhood, our thugs are going to take it on the chin. And that's exactly what's happening in the neighborhood of Russia, in an area where the Slavic civilization was actually born, where two Greek priests went up there to give them an alphabet in the 9th century when they had an oral, rich oral tradition, but no written language, 9th century after Christ, okay, where the Russians have always tried to catch up since then and have this very well-deserved inferiority complex. Well, now they have a very strong leader, Vladimir Putin, and he's just not going to put up with this stuff. And when people look at things, even Americans, you know, with all this drumbeat about what a terrible guy Putin is, when the latest poll came in this morning, only 29% of Americans, writ large, want the United States to take a firm stand against Putin. 56% say, yeah, let's not get too involved in this thing. And among independents, it's even starker. 62% are against, 25% have succumbed to the propaganda. So it's a no-win situation. What should happen, in my view, is that the Russians have sort of played a high card here. They have said that they're going to have a referendum on the Ukraine independence, okay? Now, what does that mean? Well, unless somebody sees that for what I think it is, a bargaining chip, you know, the Russians really don't need to annex the Crimea again. But as a bargaining chip, if the U.S. Has any sense at all, they'll put into play some bargaining chip which will allow them to recede, to say, okay, this was a bad idea, and as gracefully as possible, not try to put Ukraine in NATO as the U.S. has done with so many other, not only East European satellites, as we used to call them, but constitutive parts of the previous Soviet Union, like the Baltic republics. So that's the name of the game. Putin's not going to stand for further encroachment by NATO on his close-in frontier, as the Russians describe Ukraine and other countries on the periphery.
Well, certainly the Russian relationship to Crimea predates the birth of the United States, and the idea that somehow Crimea, because Khrushchev, in an act of generosity in 1954, which could have been declared illegal at that point, decided to make Ukraine an independent country because of past sins committed by the Soviet Union against the Ukrainian people, so it was. This is astonishing. I mean, the Americans have no knowledge about that region in general. They learn very little about it in public school. But even just imagine if Russia was meddling on our border, north or south, how up in arms our warmongers would be.
Well, of course, we have that Cuban example back in 62 and other times after Castro took over. I think we should clarify that Khrushchev gave the Crimea to the Ukraine while the Ukraine was still part of the Soviet Union. It was only after the dissolution of the Soviet Union that Ukraine got its independence. But you make a more general point, which is really important. You talked about our War of Independence and how we became independent at the end of the 18th century. Well, that was exactly the time when Catherine the Great finally extended Moscow's Rich, or Petersburg's Rich, down to the Crimea. That's when it became the headquarters of the Russian Navy in that part of the world. That's when Russia really was coming out of a terrible, terrible period. And this is probably worth mentioning because I don't think most Americans realize the background of the Russian experience. I mentioned that they were, you know, like two millennia behind Greece and Rome in getting a written alphabet only in the ninth century. And then Knyaz Vladimir, the Prince Vladimir of Kiev, decided, well, hey, maybe it'd be a good idea to become Christians. So he put all his subjects in the Dnieper River, and all of a sudden, Kiev and Rus, which was the first Slavic center, well, they all became Christians, okay? Now, what happened then? Well, they started to sort of come out of the into the Dark Ages, as Europe was, but then all of a sudden, they're invaded by Genghis Khan, okay? Now, how long were they occupied by the Golden Hordes? 2 centuries plus. You know, 1200s, 1300s. They didn't come out of what they call Tatarsky Iga, the Tatar yoke, until, you know, well into the 13th century. Now, what was happening in Western Europe? We were coming out of the Dark Ages. We were coming almost into the Renaissance. And why do I say all this? Well, I say all this because even then, after they got rid of the Tatars, they had to contend with the Swedes and the Lithuanians and the Poles who were attacking them from the west. And it wasn't until, you know, Peter the Great finally took power around 1701 or so, that they were able to get their act together. Later, Catherine the Great, the end of that century, and they became a strong country. Now, what does that mean? Well, they were a strong country, but they were still two centuries behind the rest of Europe. There's this expression, you scratch a Russian and you find a Tatar. Well, that's true, and they don't like that at all because they want to be very much part of Europe, and they excel, of course, in some of the arts and most of technology, but they feel kind of dishonored, and this was the ultimate dishonor, where after the falling apart of the Soviet Union in 1991, and the question being what happens to all the Warsaw Pact nations, the ones in Eastern Europe, including East Germany. You'll recall that Germany was divided into East and West, and that was, that was, Jeff, as you know, that was seen as a big advantage, not only to the Soviet Union, but also to the rest of us. The only thing worse than the reunited Germany for those post-war years was hell itself, okay? Now, all of a sudden, we have no East Germany. What happens to the 20 divisions? 20 divisions of Soviet troops there. Well, the Russians are in no position to strike many bargains. So when Jim Baker, who was George H.W. Bush's Secretary of State, when he went over to talk to his opposite number, Shevardnadze, and also Gorbachev, and they said, well, all right, look, the Russians said, you know, we're going to pull our troops out of East Germany for obvious reasons. But look, Germany's going to be reunited again, and we don't much care for that. But we're willing to allow that, and we're willing to even allow for a reunited Germany being part of NATO. But please, please, let's have a gentleman's agreement that you won't pick off Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Romania, the Baltics. There's no more Warsaw Pact. NATO is a defensive alliance to protect against the Warsaw Pact. So for God's sake, no NATO in these countries I just mentioned. Jim Baker said, okay, that sounds reasonable. Okay, that's a good deal. You get your troops out of Eastern Europe, we reunite Germany. Germany stays a part of NATO. Yeah, we'll honor that deal. Now, they didn't honor it. Clinton didn't honor it. And as you know, not only parts of Eastern Europe, but parts of the former Soviet Union, like Estonia, like Latvia, like Lithuania, they became part of NATO. And so, you know, Putin, you know, he doesn't have to be paranoid. He doesn't have to be Russo-centric to feel that he's been tricked, that the Russians have been done dirty again, and now Ukraine is the last straw. They're not going to fold on Ukraine, just as they didn't fold on Georgia five, 7 years ago. So what the neoconservatives thought they could do is either break Ukraine into two pieces, or to entice them into Europe on the pretext that they'd have a better economic situation, whereas in reality, the IMF and Wall Street restrictions would have left them the same basket case that we have in Greece right now. In any case, they thought they could do that, but it ain't going to work. And Putin is there to see that it doesn't work. And what really bothers me is that the sophomores around our own President Obama don't seem to have any appreciation of how stupid and how foolish it is to go with your gang into another schoolyard in another neighborhood and think that you can prevail.
Well, obviously, this history is so important, and it's something that the American public is not aware of. It seems clear, the given or obvious or likely to me, that given that Ukraine is a basket case, an economic basket case, in which could have received a $15 billion handout from Putin without an IMF program, austerity program, that a deal might be made in which the U.S. would pay Ukraine for allowing it to install U.S. missiles facing the Soviet Union, or that could be faced to the Soviet Union, in exchange for helping them pay their debt. I see something much more sinister, I think, as you do in this arrangement. What are the neocons after? It's just not just bringing Russia down, even with regime change in Russia, but also putting more missiles surrounding Russia as if the Cold War had never ended.
You make a really good point there, Jeff, and maybe that's the reason why the neocons are trying to sabotage the agreement that is almost to be reached with Iran. Because for your listeners, ostensibly, the anti-missile system, the missile defense system that was to be installed or partly is installed in Poland, in Czechoslovakia, and now, as you suggest, perhaps they had ideas that they could put it in the Ukraine. If they did, they're crazy. These were all aimed at Iran, of course, ostensibly. Iran had this big threat with these ICBMs, which they don't have any of, or which the MRBMs they don't have any of, with nuclear weapons, which they stopped working on a decade ago. So, you know, if you read the New York Times, well, you don't know the rest of the situation. All you know is that these anti-ballistic missile systems are designed to meet a future threat from Iran. Now, what happens if this deal is worked out with Iran, where not only do they not work on ICBMs, but they put stringent safeguards in, intrusive inspections, and reassure the whole world that they're not working on a nuclear weapon? What then? As you know, Jeff, the anti-ballistic missile system is the biggest corporate welfare program that has ever existed in the world. Billions and billions and billions of dollars have been wasted, and I say wasted advisedly. There is no reputable scientist that tells me or tells anyone else that you can mount a missile system to defend against other missiles without it being readily and easily and quickly overwhelmed by decoys and everything else. So it may be that it would be very good for, you know, the defense contractors of the United States to build still more missile systems, but it's going to be a stretch even for our allies to swallow the rationale that this is against the non-existent Iranian threat, much less a non-existent Korean threat at that distance. Who's going to be a threat? Well, it could be that the Russians would start another program. It's not going to be saleable. And that's big bucks, Jeff. And money talks. And when you talk about this kind of defense outlay, you're talking about a lot of oxes being gored. And that's part of the explanation for this whole thing. And it is really, really sorrowful that it has to come to that. But everybody's involved in it, not only the defense contractors, but the congressional people who are bought and sold by the defense contractors, and I dare say a lot of the administration, which feels powerless to deal with these people because they have so damn much money.
Well, it's interesting you brought up the Iran situation, because clearly the neocons, even while Israel and Iran and the U.S. and Iran were allies, has had targeted the Soviet Union, now Russia, and are not happy with any attempts, successful attempts by any U.S. president to establish a cordial relationship with Russia, a reset, so to speak. And so perhaps by causing this ruckus in Ukraine, that they hope to take Russia out of the Vladimir Putin out of the U.S. Circle of potential friends over not only Iran but also Syria, and it, I also want to ask you about certain similarities, although there are many differences between Syria and the and Ukraine. But it seems that the U.S. is backing some pretty strange characters, neo-fascist, right-wing lunatics in Ukraine, which seem to maybe the counterparts of the ultimate, the extremist Islamic jihadists who we are backing in Syria.
Yeah, is this a great country or what? We're pretty we're pretty non-selective when we pick out which horse to back. Now, the common thread here, of course, is Israel. When you look at Syria, when was it that someone mousetrapped Obama to say, oh, red line, chemical weapons, red line? And then, you know, what happens is Bashar al-Assad starts winning the war. And something needs to happen, because who wants the war to continue? Well, the New York Times correspondent talked to some prominent Israelis, and she said, now, what's your preferred outcome in Syria? And they said, well, actually, our preferred outcome is no outcome. What? She said. Yeah, she said. They said, well, look, as long as Shia and Sunni are at each other's throats, not only in Syria, but in that whole area now, well, Israel's, profits from that, because nobody can think of hitting out on Israel when they have this internecine warfare going on. Now, that sounds pretty, doesn't sound very nice, but that's the name of the game. And that's when, all of a sudden, whoa, on the 21st of August, Jeff, you'll remember, there were chemical incidents in and around Damascus. And immediately, John Kerry, who I have to say for your audience, is a neocon, pure and simple. John Kerry got up on the 30th of August in the afternoon at the State Department and said, we know that Bashar al-Assad is responsible for those chemical attacks in Damascus. That's the red line that the president has set, and so we will have to take appropriate action. Okay? He said, we know, 35 times in the space of 1 hour, methinks he doth protest too much. And guess what, Jeff? He was lying. He was lying through his teeth because he didn't know.
What was interesting?
Oh, okay. My former colleagues in the CIA and in the Defense Intelligence Agency knew, number one, that the rebels had sarin gas. Number two, that the alleged rockets that were supposed to have shot the sarin gas into the places where people died, they only had a range of 2 kilometers, and it was 8 kilometers away from the government-held territory. They also knew that this celebrated trajectory analysis was bogus because one of the things they were relying on hit the side of a building and, vitiated the trajectory analysis. Now, that didn't prevent the New York Times from putting this all over the front page, but they did have the, I suppose, regard for human sensibilities to retract that on page 18, paragraph 18, about 2 weeks later, saying they were wrong about that. Now, places like Human Rights Watch did not retract that. They drank the Kool-Aid, I think probably because their agenda is to get rid of Bashar al-Assad as much as Kerry wanted. The point being here that you really have to look at cui bono. Who does it profit to keep this turmoil, this incredible killing and carnage going in Syria? And the answer is Israel, pure and simple. And the trick is to get the U.S. involved, and they thought they had the U.S. involved. And guess what happened? Right after Kerry said that 35 times on the afternoon of 30 August, the president said he was going to make a speech in the Rose Garden around noon the following day, which was a Saturday. We're out in front of the White House with all kinds of signs saying, hands off Syria, don't invade Syria, don't even missile attack and all that kind of stuff. And the president gets up and he says, you know, I've been talking to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he tells me that our forces are in position, we're ready, but we don't have to do this attack today or tomorrow or next week, or we could do it next month. And so I've decided to go to Congress to ask for proper authorization. That blew us out of the water. Oh, my goodness, the president's got religion. He remembers there's a constitution here. Why did he do that? I'll tell you why he did it. Because the honest intelligence analysts and the military didn't want any part of what Kerry called a unbelievably small war, in quotes, in against Syria. They went to the president and they said, look, Kerry is talking to his hat. We don't know who's responsible for those chemical attacks. We do know that it's equally possible, at least, that it was the rebels trying to mousetrap you because of that foolish red line. And so, Mr. President, I'm sure that the Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, said, look, Mr. President, if you order us to do this now, I'm going to be asked by the press tomorrow and the next day, why couldn't you have waited until the UN inspectors came back from Damascus and from Syria? Why do you have to do that now? And you know what I'm going to have to say, Mr. President? I'm going to have to say, be sick out of me. Go ask the president. Now, I think Obama finally got some religion. And guess what? Who pulled his chestnuts out of the fire? A fellow by the name of Vladimir Putin, who said, Mr. President, we can help you out on this. If chemical weapons is a big worry to you guys, we think we can persuade the Syrians to destroy their chemical weapons. Something that John Kerry had said just the week previous would never happen. They'd never do that, okay? Well, luckily, Obama worked behind Kerry's back, directly with Putin and their foreign secretary, Lavrov. And just as the place, the whole thing was simmering, what happened was Lavrov got up and he said, yes, I think the Syrians are ready to have their weapons destroyed. And sure enough, the Syrian foreign minister got up two hours later and said, yep, we're ready to do that. The chemical weapons are on their way out of the country. Now, does this endear Putin to the neocons? No. They hate him yet from another picture now, you know? So it's Syria, as you mentioned. It's Iran. And if the neocons can cause real bad blood between the U.S. and Russia over the Crimea, over Ukraine, then so much the better. Then maybe Syria won't be solved. Maybe the chemical weapons won't be taken completely out of the country. And maybe they can put the kibosh on this very, very lucrative deal between the U.S. and the Western powers and Iran, which would achieve all the goals that the U.S. has been pressing for, but it's not really what Israel is pressing for. They simply want the U.S. to do to Iran what they persuaded the U.S. to do to Iraq, namely destroy the country.
It seems that they're succeeding in doing that, and it doesn't seem that there are hawks in Congress who are ready to pose with any character. You see, the McCain has visited. He's famous for visiting with people who would probably be on Interpol's list or maybe on Interpol's list. And we see the situation with the ultra right in Ukraine. Getting back to that. The head of this so-called right sector is going to be running for president, and his fighters were the meanest and toughest, and they're still masked in the Maidan Square. And do you see the possibility of actually a right-wing election victory in Ukraine? And if so, what implications will that have for our U.S. policy?
Well, Well, you know, I think some of that has already happened. When they got rid of Yanukovych, the people behind that are various stripes. The violence that was incited, we know from some intercepted telephone messages that these same snipers were shooting at each side, at both sides, or at all sides, to stir up this violence, which led to the removal of many people, including Yanukovych. And so who's all behind all this stuff? Well, we know that, again, maybe just a trace of Russian history is interesting here. We know that after Catherine the Great expanded the empire down there to the Crimea and the Black Sea, well, pretty soon Napoleon invaded. We know what happened there. That was pretty traumatic. And not very long after that, of course, a century later, Hitler invaded. Now, what happened in Ukraine when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union? Well, there are a lot of people, one fellow by the name of Bandera, who collaborated with the Nazis, who sent all the Jews off to Auschwitz or some other camp, who killed lots of Ukrainians who were fighting for their independence. Everybody remembers that, especially the Russians. And the Russians remember, too, that it was they who turned back the Wehrmacht long before we came in on the war en masse at Volgograd and at Kursk. Major battles, they turned back the Nazi invaders and lost in the process, count them, 26 million Russians, okay? They're not going to forget that, and they're not going to forget these Nazi supporters, these, I don't know what you call them, that they have various names now in Ukraine, but many of them played a central role in what's been happening over the last several months, and that's additional fuel on the fire for Putin, who's just not going to allow that, and no Russian is going to withdraw support from Putin when Putin puts it in those kinds of historic terms.
Well, Ray, we're coming to the end of the hour. We're going to have to revisit this again. Your history of Russia is very important. It's something that we do not see or hear about in the media. Sunday, we're going to have that election in Crimea. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. It was, again, great meeting you in New York. I'm looking forward to another conversation very soon because this problem was not going away. Take care.
You're most welcome, Jeff.